It's good to see you tonight. It's always a pleasure to be in front of people who love God and that your faith is deep, that your willingness to look at a passage such as 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So I was thinking about, on a side note, as you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when the Ethiopian eunuch, he was met by Philip the evangelist, and the eunuch was reading from Isaiah the prophet. How many people do you find that read from Isaiah the prophet? Okay? And so I've actually seen a stranger, saw a stranger one time in a place up on the north side of town reading their Bible. I'm like, what are you reading? They said, Isaiah. So not very often, though, do you find someone that's reading Isaiah, because it's not what we would call just casual reading. It's not casual reading. The same thing is true with 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he's talking about that which the Christian wants to know in order that he might, in a world of darkness, know that he is set apart. In a world of darkness, know that he is set apart. And so, good to see you, Brother Lewis, and I'm calling you out because a lot of things that you have told me about, you know, some of the jobs that you've had, you see a lot of corruption and darkness that's in our community. And you're trying to, you know, keep your head above water and keep your trust in the Lord. And so we all exist in that. Whether or not we all know it, we all exist in a world of darkness, and we are in that world to shine, of course, as lights in the world and to give God the glory for that. And so he starts with this statement, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, in sort of a new section, but it's not really a new section because everything naturally flows. In verse 14, he says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to the wise men, as to wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. What he's saying is this. Don't think that you're so smart that this isn't going to touch you. Those who are said to be wise might say, I know all the evil that's around me, but I'm better than that. I'm stronger than that. I know how to overcome all the temptations that are in the world around me, and this is not going to scar me. He says, I'm speaking to people that think they're better, people that think they're stronger. They may even look down upon other Christians who say, I'm really guarded. I don't want to fall to idolatry. And we'll talk about the definition of idolatry in just a moment. But the idea is if we see those who have stumbled and we're saying, that can never happen to me, it's sort of like Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1 where he says, brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. He says, you're thinking that you're above this. He says, you may not be above this. You think you're above this, but it can sweep you in too. Do not be wise in your own conceits. Think about the danger that's involved. And I believe the first half of this chapter, he's going to persuade about the danger. He is trying to cultivate in the mind of the Christian. The Apostle Paul, as he writes, he's trying to cultivate a conscience. A conscience that says danger is there. There is danger. And this can come in an unsuspecting way, and it can deceive you, and it can overthrow you. So the history of idolatry affected both Jews and Gentiles. It spread across all dispensations. We talk about the patriarchal dispensation. The word dispensation means administration. How God operated his will through different administrations on the earth. First off, he just worked through families, through the fathers of each family. That's the patriarchal dispensation. The second of which was the Mosaical. That is, God then legislated to a certain group on the earth, the Jews, through Moses, and ruled them through Moses. And then, of course, lastly, what we have now is that through Christ, God administers his will. And so what I want you to see is that through any of these three dispensations, idolatry has been a problem, been a big problem. Two different passages of which I refer to. One of is Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. This is where he's talking about men who are and women who are given to idols, idolatry. They can know about God, but they don't realize who God is. So what do they turn to? They turn to idols. It says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 23, or verse 22, he says, professing to be wise, they become fools and change the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness, in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. In this, he says, they've elevated something else to divine status. So idolatry is when the things created are elevated to divine status. When objects, relationships, earthly rulers, or fleshly lust. And in that, he was talking about animals, worshiping animals. That's an object. That's something that exists in nature. He's talking about fleshly lust. So a man even elevates his own body, the cravings of his own mind and body, to divine status. And then he feeds those things. He worships that. And this is not a case of which someone says some kind of ornament, and we think of an idol, maybe a statue, maybe it's wood, or maybe it's some kind of metal, and it's stuck up here on a shelf, or maybe in the middle of the floor. No, it's the idea that any of these objects, relationships, earthly rulers, or fleshly lusts, they're worshipped. They are served as God. They are then sacrificed to as keeper. In other words, our existence depends on these things. And so let me give you some examples. It's not on the slide. You don't have to write this down. But when it comes to objects, for instance, Ahab, who was king of Israel, he wanted his neighbor's vineyard. His wife then conspired to get the neighbor murdered so that Ahab could get his vineyard, okay? And so Ahab wanted to own the vineyard. In fact, he couldn't sleep at night thinking about the vineyard. If someone says, when I get whatever, then I'm going to be satisfied. And so what happened with Ahab was, his wife saw him pouting, and he says, I want my neighbor's vineyard. And he gets his neighbor's vineyard at the cost of his neighbor's life. And then when he gets the vineyard, Elijah comes along and points out that he doesn't own the vineyard. What has happened is the vineyard owns him. Covetousness is when our stuff, when objects, anything material, anything that is in nature owns us. I put relationships. Some would sell themselves out for relationships. King Solomon had this problem. It said in 1 Kings chapter 11 that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and that for these wives who were foreign, he constructed idols. Do you see where this relationship was elevated? And because of that, it translated to idolatry. He constructed idols. And we can put somebody in our life of which now is our God, our keeper. This person is our hope. Everything relies upon this person. And that's idolatry. Earthly rulers. In Revelation chapter 13, it was said that the beast, of which was worshipped by men, was in respect parallel to the government. The government. Some say, well, that was the Roman Empire. Maybe that was the emperor. But it's parallel to the government. Someone says, if we get the government fixed, then everything's going to be right. I will have my keeper, and I will have my hope. And so you hear those words, those ideas, a lot in the rhetoric of campaigns, right? A new hope, a new hope. And we're thinking this, when we go to our caucus, when we go to our caucus and our neighborhood, community, political discussions, and somebody says, God has no part in government. Don't bring God into government. And let me tell you this, God was already there. But the idea that someone that says, God has no part in our government, well, where is and who is our keeper? Who is our hope? God employs government. God made government. Nothing wrong with the idea of government and the need for government. But when we have mistaken that government is our keeper, government is our hope, then we have elevated it to an idol status, to a divine status. That's idolatry. Or even fleshly lust. Again, the cravings of man, in 1 Peter chapter 4, when he talks about those who were given to their lust, 1 Peter chapter 4, and he says that they go into their drinking parties. And this is sort of their drive. And then revelry, and anything that is associated with that, which again goes into all kinds of immorality, and it's all part of it. And someone says, that's my ticket. And so in our communities, we have those kinds of associations where it revolves around the alcohol. It revolves around the sensitivity of the flesh. And it's exciting, very exciting. I know people that are in their 60s and 70s that still buy into that. They think that that's still where it's at. And that might shock you because usually we associate that with the younger group, people that, you know, stay up past 9 o'clock. And I'm snickering about that because really when you see the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, those three things of which Jesus overcame, of which we're warned about, which are of this world, which pass away, but those who do the will of the Father live forever. Those things are not unique necessarily to any age group, even though sometimes they are more so in one than the others. The Apostle Paul told Timothy, flee also youthful lust. So idolatry is powerful. It's deceptive. But it's not as powerful as God. To wise men, those who think, I've got this mastered, he says, don't be too smart for your own good. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, then verse 16, this is the persuasion. What I call is the persuasion. And I'll turn that off for a second. Let's read these verses, 16 through 22. 1 Corinthians 10, 16 through 22. He says, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body. For we all partake of that one bread. Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifice partakers of the altar? What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons, and not to God, and I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Now let's look at this point by point. The first of which is, he says, the communion with Christ's sacrifice exists by partaking of the Lord's Supper. So we eat of the bread, we drink of the fruit of the vine. He said, what are you doing there? Are you just having food and drink? What are you doing there? He says, no, actually what you're doing by the partaking of that food is that you're demonstrating that you have communion with. That means you have fellowship with what Jesus' sacrifice did for us. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing. So he parallels that with the communion with the altar. He says that those who are priests under the flesh, under Israel, he said when they ate of those sacrifices, he says they become partakers of the altar. What's the altar represent? It's participating in God's system of atonement for sins for the Israelites. And so they would eat of that. Their agreement is implied, but they're participating with that. And then he's saying this, don't think that we can fellowship God through Jesus Christ. In other words, we're partaking of those things that represent the sacrifice of Christ and at the same time, fellowship idols. He says, you can't do that. You just can't do that. And so someone says, I can balance this. I had a fellow Christian one time told me that he believed that he could sort of put his foot into the world and even things that are quite sensual. He could sort of be involved in these sort of things and maintain his integrity as a Christian. And it would be like this. And I had Brother W.R. Jones say this one time. He says, try doing this sometime. Convince your wife that you can walk down the sidewalk holding her hand, and then you've got some other woman that's just a casual friend and hold her hand at the same time and says, it won't affect me. That just blows my mind. Okay, that just blows my mind. Certainly wouldn't convince my wife of that. That just blows my mind. He says, here you are partaking of Jesus Christ, and now that you're going to dabble in idolatry. You're dabbling in that which shows that you trust stuff more than you trust God, that you trust alcohol or you trust sensual relationships more than you trust God, or you think you can balance the two at the same time. You trust your rulers, you trust your government like they were deity. He says, you can't do this. You cannot do this. It cannot be balanced. You either eat of one altar, that is the altar of Christ, or you eat of the altar of idols. But he says, Christ is not going to share his communion with you. He's not going to share it. two ways in which we look at that. The fellowship is that Christ says either I'm in and I'm in alone or I'm not in. The other of which is when it comes to God as our almighty God, he does not share his throne with any other power. He does not share his throne with any other power. This provokes God. The commandment that was given by Moses that you would have no other gods before you, that you would not construct these gods, for God is a jealous God. He is a jealous God, and that's what he alludes to. Don't provoke the Lord to jealousy. That which is rightfully his is us. If we try to share ourselves with some other constructed deity, then we are provoking the Lord to jealousy. Two things there that I don't want you to miss as we move on. One is, don't think that you're strong enough to take on idols by yourself. He says, the deception is strong, it's powerful, it pulls you in. Then all of a sudden you can't get people's attention away from whatever their idol is. Whether it be their stuff, their relationships, whether it be their rulership, whether it be their personal physical lust, whatever it is. You can't get their attention from that. In fact, they don't even seem to be on the same planet when you have a conversation. He says, it's powerful, and don't think that you can go toe-to-toe with that power. Why? He says, because this power, second level, this power is what is introduced and influenced by demons. Demons are powerful. If you're left alone with a demon outside of God and his care, you've had it. You have had it. So you see all the demon possession that took place in the life of Jesus and also in the experiences of the Apostle Paul. When they cast out demons, the apostles all did this and had that ability. But basically, until you had the power of God, humans on their own are not equal in power to demons. But then he says this. You think you can fight the flesh, you think you can fight your idolatry, you think you can fight demons, and now as you try to balance this, you actually have made God your enemy, you think you can handle that. You are not more powerful than God. You've made God angry now, and you think, I can handle that. I can keep God where he needs to be. You cannot handle that. This is the section of which I call, and I didn't put it on the slide, but persuasion. Persuasion. He's trying to give them a persuasion, to give them a consciousness of the danger of idolatry. And so, you know someone that's left the Lord, and pretty much you can pinpoint that the idea of idolatry, they've elevated something to be divinity in their life, of which is not God. And now the fight's on, the battle is really on, to pull them back out of them there, to get their loyalty, their allegiance back to God Almighty. So he's saying, okay, in Corinth, especially, he uses the example, we'll talk about some other examples like we just spoke of, but he uses the example of eating meats that have been offered to an idol at Corinth. And he's saying this. He says, how much can you eat meat in Corinth and not giving the indication that you've caved into idolatry? How much can you do that? So we read then verses 23 through the end. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 23 says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Verse 27, if any of those who, he says, do not believe, invite you to dinner, and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, and for the conscience sake. For, again, he says, quoting Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I give thanks? Therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. And then chapter 11 and verse 1, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. So living in the city of Corinth, for instance, you'd go to the marketplace and there'd be meat at the marketplace. For us, we'd just go to Walmart. We'd go to Walmart, we'd go over there, and for me, I went to Walmart and I bought a pound of bacon. I think it was a pound of bacon, okay? Back then, you bought the pound of bacon if you were a Gentile. If you're a Jew, you bought lamb, probably, okay? But you bought the meat. Very likely that meat could have been used in a worship unto idols. And so worship unto idols, first off, was corrupt. They would take the same meat that had been offered to an idol, and now it's the meat, it's the barbecue, if you will, and then they would take it to the marketplace and make money off of it. So idolatry was a money maker. It was a money maker. So it was corrupt from the standpoint that it was offered to an idol that doesn't really exist. And he says idols don't really exist. We know that. But in someone's mind, if they have elevated something to be divine, he says that changes everything. So they do that. Some would go to the temple of an idol, and they would participate in harlotry, prostitution. They would participate in that, either as a female or as a male. Either one, they would participate in that. And so they would use this religion, this idolatry, as a moneymaker. That's what they would use it for, as a moneymaker. And then you see the money that would come as a proceed of that, that you're saying, well, what about that money? Is that, that's filthy money, okay? What about that? He's saying you see these things that come through your life, through the economy or through the marketplace. They come through your life and you're saying, do I have to investigate everything and figure out what's what? And I don't want to have any participation with idols. That's what he's saying. He's indicating we need to be mindful of just, not just the actual item, either the money, the gold, the silver, or whether it be the food or the drink. It's not just a matter of these items. He says if that's all it was a matter of, we know academically that God is the ruler of all. He says what you want to make sure of is that you give no indication that you are in fellowship and you are a partaker of those things which are evil in our community. That's kind of hard. Things kind of slip up on you. Twice he quoted Psalm 24. So before I put the slide back up, I want to look at Psalm 24. And as is the case, usually when he quotes from a psalm, he's alluding to the entire psalm. It's a very short psalm. We're going to read it. Psalm 24, he says, the earth is the Lord's in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. And I think everybody would give a hearty amen to that. It all belongs to God. And that's what he's saying in regard to idolatry. It says in verse 2, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol. So that's why it's interjected in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, because Psalm 24 is contrasting God who made it all, who owns it all. It's all about God. And now someone wants to turn to God. He says you cannot turn to God if your hands are unclean with a heart that is given into idolatry. He says, verse 4 again, he who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is Jacob, the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face. So he's talking about God and God's power, and that if the person and if the community will wholly say that I trust God and his power, that I do not walk according to this world. So here's the man that says, I'm not owned by possessions. I'm not owned by my flesh. I'm not owned by my pride. I haven't elevated myself to be my own God. He says there's a man that's got clean hands and clean heart. And he's come to this place. This is a man that the Lord will bless. This is a man that becomes the Lord's Israel, the Lord's family. And so that is who he is, and he knows what he's about. And so we would say in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when he says in verse 25, eat whatever is sold in the marketplace, asking no questions for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. He says, we know that really there's no idols, and this meat is not truly, literally tainted. It's all in concept. It's all in concept. If someone has idolatry in their mind regarding that meat, then it changes everything. And so I'll turn the slide back on. We look at slide number 3. When can we eat meat or drink? If meat or drink is not offered to idols, it's just meat or drink, and it's never been offered to idols. He says you can eat it. It has no part in those things which are idolatrous. If we have no knowledge of its prior use, he said you find it in the marketplace, you go to Walmart, you buy it, and if it doesn't say this was bought with money that was made from, you know, prostitution or idolatry, he says, go ahead and eat it. You don't have to ask questions. Why? He says, because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. It's still just meat. It has no evil connotation in it. But do not eat it if we have knowledge that there is some evil connotation around it. Do not eat it if those around us are caused to suspect idolatry in us. So a couple of things when we come to association. That is, for instance, there are places that we could go to right here in Colorado Springs. Like, for instance, if I went to a, quote, gay bar, okay? And you're saying, well, why would Carl go there? Well, if I just go there and I hang around there, what are people probably going to assume? We know that. If I go to a bar or a theater or some kind of dining spot that is typically constructed as being a party place for alcohol and sensual activity, sensual connections, those kinds of things, it may not be homosexual, but if I go to a place like this, someone says, well, why would Carl go there? It's going to make others, again, conclude that I'm buying into that kind of arrangement, that I'm buying into that kind of arrangement. I remember a business person that said when they went to a business meeting, and sometimes at business meetings in their corporation, drinks are just flowing like rivers, okay? And so someone comes along and says, would you like a drink? And so in order for him to posture himself in an environment where some might conclude that he was just buying into everything that everybody else was thinking about alcohol, he says, I'll have a milk. For two reasons. He says, one thing, they brought it in a tumbler that didn't look like the normal tumblers and different kinds of vessels in which they served alcohol. And another guy, he says, when I go, I order bottled water. That's where it says the brand name of the water right there on it. He says, I want to make sure people don't think that, you know, they brought me some kind of tumbler. They put water in there. They think I'm drinking, you know, some kind of wine or vodka or whatever it might be. So he's making distinctions. He wants people to know that, just so that he erases any suspicion about what he's doing. And so when we hear evil said in the workplace, we don't kind of chuckle along with it. We disagree. That wasn't nice. We show distinction. If we can't show distinction, then we don't go. And in business and in government, oftentimes decisions which grant the economy, which permit the contract, if you will, that fund whatever we're trying to do. Sometimes those are made around drinking arrangements, these kinds of associations. And you're saying, unless I get involved in that, I'm not going to be able to feed my family. And some have said, if that's the way of which I'm going to have to feed my family, we're going to eat less. We're going to eat less. The point is this. He's saying, if I see that it's going to jeopardize me in any way, it's going to jeopardize me or indicate that I have a part with that which is idolatry, I'm not going to even be associated with that. But he's saying there are ways of which you could be around it, and as long as you give no indication that you're participating, and it's not suspicious that you're partaking or participating in idolatry, he says, you make the decision. So it becomes a little complicated. It becomes a matter of prayer. He says, do not do it if it causes others to stumble in idolatry. So someone says, I know what I'm doing. I can go smack dab into a bar and sit there and not drink anything and enjoy the conversation with my friends. And then my neighbor, he goes in there with me, and one smell of alcohol and he's gone, okay? I mean, not gone out the door. He's into the alcohol. All because of my influence. And so I have, by my influence, not been considerate of others, even though I might say, I'm just drinking water. Or I'm just going to eat something that's going to be, you know, totally right before God. He says, you've got to consider the other person. And then finally, seek not our own. Seek not our own, but the other's well-being. So if you take that back to the original statement that was made in this paragraph of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when he says in verse 15, I speak as to wise men, judge for yourselves. He's saying, you've got to stop and think about this. This is not just clear cut. This is a case where you've really got to think about it. Then he gives the persuasion, use your conscience. Then the final, if you will, the final thing of which he says is, imitate me, Paul, as I imitate whom? He says, as I imitate Christ. As I imitate Christ. Remember Jesus that forfeited his own rights. Jesus who was reviled, he reviled not. Jesus who was smitten, he was struck, he was crucified. Someone says, well, don't take that. He says, I'll take it. I'll take it. Romans chapter 15 and verse 3, Jesus who pleased not himself but suffered our reproaches. He says, I'm going to go ahead and forego some of the things that are my rights. And someone says, but I'm really hungry. I am really hungry. We talked about 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the Apostle Paul says, if it's going to cause somebody to stumble, I'll never eat meat again. I'll never eat meat. In other words, I'm going to eat vegetables. I'm going to eat less. It won't be as filling. I will eat less, he says, because the greater goal here is the salvation of others. I'm being considerate of others. So I call the sermon this, communion with Christ or idols. It's one or the other. Communion with Christ or idols. It's one or the other. We have to have a conscience. We have to have behavior. We have to have influence that is going to show that our communion is with Christ. I'm through preaching now. Appreciate you looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 10.